Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and on today's show, we have Frank Ono. He is the founder and president of the iFish Group, and he's been one of these people that's quietly successful in the region. He works with the state of California and other government entities to help them with technological solutions to build their business, and sometimes we don't end up hearing as much about people that don't have those direct-to-consumer or front-facing companies. So we decided to bring on Frank today because he's an incredible story, and I hope you like it. At the end of the show, we're actually going to do something where we're going to go a little bit longer with me, and I'm going to talk about the one ingredient that you need if you want to start a company or do something really spectacular in your life. There's one ingredient that you need, and there's one thing that you need to do. So stick around, enjoy the story of Frank Ono, and at the end of the show, we'll talk a little bit about my view on the one ingredient that you need. This is the Mark Haney Show. Wing it with confidence is the motto, or one of the mottos of today's guest, Frank Ono. He is the founder of the iFish Group. He's the president, chief strategist of this software company, or this high-tech company. We're going to talk a little bit today about Frank's company, but we're also going to talk a little bit about how to win as an entrepreneur, what it's like to win, and maybe what it's like when you're not winning, or what it feels like you're not winning. So, Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
You bet. Okay, if you don't mind, maybe give us a little bit of your background and what inspired you to become an entrepreneur.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think I would have to go all the way back to college, which I was in the early 1980s. I was a double major, chemical engineer, computer science major at the University of Colorado. Interestingly enough, the summer after my freshman year, I went to an internship with Marathon Oil and figured out in one day that there was no chance I was going to be doing that for a living. So at the time, I thought it would be best to just take a step back and reevaluate my options. And to be honest with you, I figured out that at the end of the day, I have a difficult time working for other people.
It's funny. Some people, I guess most of the population is sort of like geared that way, but some of us, have a little trouble with that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some level, you know, in my mind, I've thought that leaders have to be perfect. In other words, they have to really know what they're doing. They have to be very good at guiding and making decisions. But the reality is people are people. You're going to find all kinds of people, all kinds of different walks, all kinds of experience, styles. And if they don't fit your ideal mold of what you expect, then a lot of times you find yourself really, let's just say, underwhelmed, yeah, and on some level frustrated. So for me, when I looked around after taking the year off in college, seeing a number of friends of mine that had done really well in financial markets, knowing that they weren't the sharpest knives in the drawer. So it made me really think about then what could I do? Because I felt I was smart enough to figure out a lot of things. The problem really was just understanding what to do. And I've spent basically three decades, like many entrepreneurs, trying a lot of different things, only to figure out that that wasn't the right thing and then moving on to something else.
Okay, so now you have something called the iFish Group. What is that? And maybe just give me the overview of that. And what is this wing it with confidence thing that you mentioned? Or you picked up on something I said, actually.
Sure. So the iFish Group, you know, when you think about what you could name your company, the iFish Group wasn't actually something I thought about from a branding perspective. Back in 2008, 2007 time, I was working for a big production home builder here in town in IT, and they gave me an opportunity to, while they were dealing with the transition and the crash, to look at other options and understanding that I could go back and help them at some point in time if needed. So at the time, I thought it was just going to be me. I was really comfortable with kind of going back to consulting. I was going to hang my own shingle. And basically, I'm a fisherman a lot. I fish a lot. And so that kind of became kind of a catchy little thing that I could call myself. But very quickly, with my very first consulting engagement, I did a big risk assessment for a public entity risk pool, and they came back and said, "Hey, we have all these other IT initiatives of things that we're not making any traction on, and we would really love some guidance on how to do that." So very quickly, I found myself moving from being a sole proprietor, single consultant guy to having a team of people. We ended up building a massive risk management platform, enterprise risk management platform for, again, a public entity risk pool. So that's how we got started. But like a lot of things, you know, you learn a lot of things in your journey as an entrepreneur. One of the things is that if you can't figure out ways to have a pipeline of things that you're going to be able to monetize at some point in time predictably, you could find yourself on the rocks pretty quickly. And as I've mentioned before, there's a funny thing about people not showing up for work when you stop paying them.
Yeah, you've got, so in other words, you've got to have a way to make some money along the way at some point.
Sure. And then, you know, part of this is, you know, there were really good times. And then when the times get tough, you have to figure out how to pivot. And that was for me, it was a really good opportunity. One of the reasons why I've also had to joint venture with other partner firms just to be able to deal with that variability and growth and stagnation, you know, in our line of businesses, which is mainly consulting.
So what's the wing it with confidence, though? I keep coming back to that because at the beginning of the show, it's like, oh, let's just wing it. Let's go. Right. And then you said, yeah, that's my line. Wing it with confidence. Where did that come from?
So one of my executives who used to be an executive with the state of California is very uncomfortable with the idea of being able to proceed forward with confidence if you don't actually understand all of the little things. So she's a consummate planner. Everything has to be done exactly a certain way. Well, one of the things I've tried to work on with her is to understand in our line of business, you don't always know what's going to go on and you can't really make that an obstacle to continuing to move forward. So, you know, one of the things that we did was to really talk about, okay, so what would this look like in practical terms? In this particular case, this person was, we were traveling down to LA for a conference and she wanted to have everything planned. She wanted to know what a trip was, where the reservations were. She wanted to call the hotel room. And I said, look, at the end of the day, even if we have to change, it's okay. We can make a decision in real time and just be comfortable with that. So that's something that we understand, that there's so much uncertainty in what we do, whether it's business or in life. And ultimately, sometimes the confidence to know that you can work through things is what helps to undergird your ability to move.
You know, one of the things I see, I think, at the Growth Factory and my other investments, we work with a lot of early stage companies, startups, and invariably, the business plan changes. You've got this big dream. You might even have an elaborate business plan, but I have never been around a startup where the plan didn't drastically change. There's almost always an enormous pivot. You still typically want to keep the North Star out there, and that doesn't change in most cases, but pivots are basically going to happen irregardless.
Yeah, and for us, we have a marketing agency that does all of our branding and marketing work. And one of the first things they did was they came in and did an interview with us. And as they started talking with, they figured out that we're very opportunistic as a company. And what that means is, you know, unlike the let's spend 3 to 5 years on a strategic plan and figure out how we're going to execute that doggedly and commit to it, it's the more the let's see what happens in the business environment. And let's be prepared to pivot if necessary, because a lot of times the opportunities are really based on the needs of the customer as opposed to our ability to say, hey, we're really super good at that. We're going to go sell that.
Yeah. So do you create a business plan at the beginning of the year, or how do you do your planning? Or it can't be all seat of the pants.
Well, so that's a really funny kind of question, because we've done strategic planning every year. The problem is what we end up executing, generally speaking, doesn't exactly look like the plan. Yeah. And a lot of that is because, you know, we, as I've told you before, we're in consulting and public sector. So we don't really get the choice of what we're going to potentially offer to a particular customer, because a lot of it is driven on their internal business initiatives and what they're trying to get done. So a lot of times what we have to look at is what kind of capabilities and knowledge and experience can we bring to help them solve that business problem. So it really forces us to kind of be somewhat agile in the approach that we use. So, you know, to a great degree, that's what we're set up to be, because I've built out portions of the company historically that we've had to basically walk away from. Everything from expansion into other states to different lines of business, only because you can't keep it going. There's not sufficient opportunities and need in a timely fashion for you to be able to make the investment and having the staff and capabilities to be able to follow up on that. Because if you don't have those opportunities, then it's a pretty easy formula for going broke.
Yeah. So let's talk about opportunities. So right now, what do you see in today's environment? if you're somebody that wants to build a business or be an entrepreneur, like what opportunities are you seeing out there today?
You know,
is it a good time to start a business?
That's actually a tough question, because there's too many other qualifiers that you need to put alongside that. So for example, you know, the whole adage of Moore's Law, I'm mm-hmm. sure you're familiar with it, that technology doubles in capability every 18 months, okay, or less, right? It's stepped right down to a year these days. So the problem about that is what that means is that every bit of technology that we know and understand today, a year from now, very likely could be different. So from that perspective, it's a new problem to solve. And almost by definition, that's opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Who should not be an entrepreneur? What kind of people do you think don't make it in entrepreneurship?
So I would say the hard part about entrepreneurship is you have to have a pretty thick outer skin and be willing to understand that failure is just part of what you're going to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Like being a fisherman, probably sometimes, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are those days where there's a lot more fishing than catching.
Yeah. Okay. So elaborate on that. So you have to be able to deal with failure.
Yeah. Because, you know, like I said, even with my own company, one of the challenges are you have a vision of what you think is possible. And so you kind of work on the putting together the pieces and parts to be able to execute on that. But if all your assumptions weren't good or the timing wasn't good, it's pretty easy to run your ship aground. In other words, I may have all these capabilities to actually deliver on something, but the opportunity that I thought would manifest ends up not being there. So now I'm stuck. I've made an investment in capabilities and people, time. And at the end of the day, if I don't have some way to monetize that, I can go broke.
You bet. You know what I've seen with people, you know, obviously there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of failures. That might be a little bit of exaggeration. There's a lot of failures out there in business. People run themselves out of business for one reason or another. But many times what I see is people, they sort of give up, right? Instead of regrouping and attacking from a different direction, finding the fish, if you will, if the customers aren't here, let's go find them over here. They tend to pivot. They tend to give up before the pivot. And so some people just aren't built to keep going year after year after year for that breakthrough.
Well, and there's two sides of that, because some of it's financial. And, you know, the wherewithal of most entrepreneurs is they have enough powder in the keg to basically go do one or two things. But beyond that, they no stay power. Yeah. At the end of the day, if you don't have the money, then it's really hard to keep your boat afloat, so to speak.
Definitely, definitely. So in your business, you're solving complex problems for large organizations. What, in terms of IT, right now, you know, that business is blowing up. Are you having trouble getting enough people? What are the big hurdles in your world today?
Well, getting back to that whole concept of being opportunistic, you know, my history is really in technology, but the company that we are today is a lot less about technology, and it's more about the types of professional resources that you need to deliver on different complex projects from the state. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right now with the state, so many of the projects require subject matter expertise around a certain system. So it's not like I can bring in a specialist in IT and expect that they're going to solve the problems. It's more that we've had to shift away from, you know, pure technical engineering type of resources to more project manager, business analyst, and tester type of people, because that's really where the demand is. And then one of the things that we did back in 2017 was we added a professional resource management group, which is basically a recruiting group with inside of our company, because so much of what we do is about finding the right people for the right job, and they have to come with specific qualifications.
But right now that's got to be difficult.
It's not. It was the smartest move that I ever made, because going back to 2016, I brought my book of business back, a long story, but I was partners with another company, and I brought my book of business back to iFish Group. And at the time we were about 1.6 million. Well, today we do about 14. So that's a pretty short amount of time to deal with that growth. That's why we were recognized as one of the fastest growing companies in Sacramento, as well as with Inc. 5000. And then the thing that we did is to really focus on the people, which is really ultimately how we do anything in our line of business. We don't own a product. We don't have assets and infrastructure per se. Everything we do is around people and how people drive success of our customers.
Well, I saw that you had also won another award for being one of the best places to work in Sacramento. How did you build a company with that kind of culture?
So, you know, I get asked this all the time, and I'll answer it this way. When I first got started in with iFish and just really thinking about how the company developed over the years, it was really focused on what I call my hiring rubric. So I don't really do the interviews. We've got recruiters with people that do that, and then we have technical folks that will sit and validate what people think they know. The only interviews I do are really looking for three things. And if you ask my staff, my leadership, they all can quote this to you. So first off is character. Second off is critical thinking. And third is solid work ethic.
Okay.
And there's a reason why I chose those three, because I'm a firm believer that any skills can be taught. But teaching character, teaching critical thinking, and teaching work ethic, you either have it or you don't.
How do you, if I'm in an interview with you, how are you going to determine whether I have those three characteristics?
So when I think about character, it's the what would you do? So you basically try to provide people with scenarios and ask them how they would respond. There's no right answer. Ultimately, you want to ask them a question that actually forces them to ponder what's most important to them. Is it the outcome or is it the integrity or the character of what they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
If you ask questions in that manner, a lot of times you can kind of get the sense of what's important to them. Because in interviews, a lot of times people just ask you what they think you want to hear. So you have to ask original questions that kind of put them in a corner.
So critical thinking. So character, I can see asking them some challenging questions that gets them to contemplate how they might handle a situation. But I'm thinking of the book, The Everything Store, I think it was, about Jeff Bezos and Amazon. They wanted to get the smartest people on the team. And one of the questions they asked in the interview was, how many manhole covers are there? I think it was in New York City. And they asked a question sort of like that. And they went and they, because they wanted to think of the critical thinking skills and the steps that somebody might go through. Well, X number of square miles and so on. There's no right or wrong answer but it's about how you think. How would you ask a question that got my critical thinking skills on display?
Well, again, depending on the type of role you're going to be playing on whatever assignment you would have, then it's really about just creating scenario-based questions that allow people, because what you really want to do is to get people to talk. If you can get them to talk, then you can get them to provide, generally speaking, more feedback than you're really looking for. And that kind of gives you a clue into how they think.
Okay. So you want teammates with character, critical thinking skills. And what was the third one?
Work ethic.
Oh, work. How do you measure that in a job interview?
Again, those are the types of things that you put them in a scenario where, you know, have you ever had a deadline to produce something where the amount of work that it was taking to do it and the amount of time that you had to do it were in conflict with one another? So what did you do? Because at the end of the day, it's either going to be, I did whatever it took to kind of get it done, mm-hmm. sort of response, or I just couldn't get it done, so I did the best I could.
Okay, so you hire the right people, but that doesn't, it starts with a good person, but it, getting them to work together in a team that makes it one of the best places to work in the region, that's not just hiring, it's beyond that.
Okay, so some of the things that we did, and I'm a huge fan of like book study and human behavioral science. So one of the things that I did was when I first organized my senior management team, they have titles that are basically managing directors of something. And each one of those people participates in this group that we call our Leadership and Innovation Board. And the whole notion of the Leadership and Innovation Board, it's a little, you know, altruistically motivated. But for my purposes, I really want to make sure that my leadership team has the ability to think on their own. So it's the whole notion of, you know, like a lot of books around succession planning. It's the how do you teach your people how to think? So what we did with our Innovation and Leadership Board is we started with the notion of a framework, which is basically a mental model of how do you go about decomposing ideas that you have that might be opportunities for us as a business or opportunities for us to change some way we're doing something. And what it allows you to do is to basically engage leadership in the thought process, and then you give them a framework that allows them to present their thoughts back to the rest of the group so that things can be evaluated in a somewhat orderly and consistent fashion. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we start with the notion of if you have an idea, form it, put it in the form of a hypothesis. And with that hypothesis, you have to have a number of things that have to be true in order for this hypothesis to succeed. Then past that, you have to design what is a small scale experiment, because I don't want to go invest a whole bunch of money, build it, and they will come. And then it fails. And then you're figuring out how you're going to undo that. And then the last thing is, how do we measure success? So as you work through that mental model, then what you end up with is something that you can go execute on. And then people can talk about what are the assumptions that you have? Because one of the most important things about a hypothesis and assumptions is your assumptions better be true. Yeah. Because if your assumptions aren't true, then people are acting on misinformation or bad information. I kind of like to think is people should be working from the perspective of making informed decisions, data-driven informed decisions. And so by sharing that amongst my leadership, they in turn take that and they use that in terms of how they communicate and in some cases, how they might communicate downline to people that work for them.
And that makes it a more enjoyable place to work.
Let's just put it this way. You're always trying to figure out how to tap the intrinsic motivation of the people that work for you. Yes. You know, I learned a long time ago, I mean, back in the 80s, I went to an Inc. conference, which was really interesting. It was trying to train business owners to transition from being a small business to a mid-sized business. And you're reading things, you know, that are really suggesting that you kind of have to think about things in terms of how do you delegate a lot of your responsibilities? Because it's really hard to scale when you're the only person doing stuff.
So that's an interesting point. One of the things that I've had some businesses that have scaled to hundreds of employees. And one of the things that I focused on, our leadership team focused on, was communication and clarity of vision and, you know, making, because if you, a company like yours is growing real fast, we grew really fast as well. It's hard to know what everybody's doing because there's a lot of people and there's a lot of moving parts. So if we're not communicating, then, you know, you don't know what the other hand's doing. Your left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. What do you do in terms of communication and where do you put that on the priority level?
Well, communication is everything, because at the end of the day, if your expectation is that people are the core of what you do and how you do it, then if those people can't collaborate and communicate together, then chances are you're going to have all kinds of things either falling through the cracks or a tremendous amount of misunderstanding and frustration.
What's the CEO's role in making sure that that happens?
So a big thing, at least for us, is what we try to do is think of it as a kind of a portfolio management approach. So you've got all these initiatives of things that you think you're trying to manage, whether they are things that you already have or things that you want to be able to do. So think of it as, for us, because we're in the contracting business with the state of California, a lot of what we do is already contracted. So we know what that is. We know we have to deal with caring feeding of both our customer as well as our team, our staff members that are on the projects. But on the flip side of that is, lost my train of thought here.
So as a CEO, as a president of a company, as the leader, the head honcho, if you will, we have to make sure our organizations are communicating with one another. What is the CEO, what do you see the role of the CEO doing? Is this the type of thing where the CEO has a company meeting once a week, once a month, once a year? How much involvement does the CEO have in making sure that there's clarity of vision so that we all are rowing in the same direction?
So one of the things that I've done is, you know, to a great degree, I've stepped away from day-to-day operations in my company. And so what happens, though, is that my teams basically organize around the work to be done. We very much follow kind of an agile development methodology, which is really about being able to understand the list of things that you have to do, really kind of grooming them in a way where you kind of pick through them, you understand, do I have sufficient detail to proceed on this? And then as you move forward, being able to tie those things back continuously. So with a lot of our teams, what we have is we use different types of Kanban boards to where actually store things, which are basic ideas or things that need to be done against different initiatives. We track it very much like a software development project, even though it's not really software, where, you know, it could be everything from, you know, changing, for example, our security. So one of the things we're doing right now is we're really bolstering our expertise in security governance within our own company. We have a number of customers that we manage their infrastructures for them. So it is in our best interest, as well as our customers' best interest, to really make sure that that is robust. And so, and we've gone so far as to hire outside auditors for SOC 2 audits to basically come in and validate the things that we say we're doing are actually happening. But what that does for us is it puts a framework around it, which is something that people can look at and identify and collaborate with. There's visibility and transparency, meaning you can see what needs to be done and as things are getting done. So as an executive, I no longer spend my time in each one of these individual initiatives across the company, I really look at how are they managing themselves. And then I can get an update at any given time. They have to show me what work is being done and how they're actually tracking it. So, you know, to undergird your collaboration communication style thing, that's what I've done. And it helps because that way my team can also collaborate that way as well.
Yeah. We only have a little bit of time left, but I'm kind of curious. So you and I were talking before the show about entrepreneurship and a little bit about the beauty of entrepreneurship. Why is entrepreneurship good for society?
Oh, my gosh. So if you think about it this way, if everybody is capable of coming up with a great idea or something that, that could be really valued by either a consumer or, like you say, our society or community. So the idea that there are no constraints to what that could be, because I think I'm a smart guy, but I'm far from the smartest guy. And there's going to be people out there with better ideas, better execution, and new problems.
Yeah.
And so the whole idea is, who's going to step up to answer and address those things if it's not an entrepreneur type person? Because those are the people that really have the passion to pour into it. It's not just about the money, although everybody would love to get rich. The reality is they start in it, they look at the opportunity, they have this dream or this idea of something they can do. And that's the kind of passion that you really want to have, because those types of people really can influence outcomes in a different way than a corporate entity that's just really looking at the numbers.
Yeah. One of my mantras is entrepreneurs solve the world's biggest problems, but they do it by taking risk, making sacrifices.
Absolutely.
They're really the heroes of the American economy because they are the ones that create opportunity that doesn't exist today. They create it out of almost like nothing. And then there's a whole group of people that just sort of support and live off of that called, whatever. I don't want to say anything negative about the government, but they're entrepreneurs. To me, they are solving huge challenges, and we've got to, and I know you believe in this, we've got to support them.
Absolutely. And again, as I mentioned before when we were speaking, I would have loved to have had somebody coaching and mentoring me when I first started, because I figured out that problem solving is something I'm fairly good at, but the problem is having to balance the what you do and then how you manage and maintain it are two very different things. I got some really good advice from a former manager, which was really helped me to really think about my new company and as it grew, what was most important, because cash flow for an entrepreneur is such a major deal, because, you know, I've already mentioned it once, you stop paying people, they stop showing up. And that's a lot of times the thing that you don't think about is how you manage your receivables, how you manage your payables. And basically sometimes you have to make hard decisions. Sometimes you have to hold on to money in order to be able to give yourself that insulation, because if everything becomes just in time, there's just so much risk associated with that.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about mentoring. How important do you think it is for successful people to give back in some way?
I think it's really important, to be honest with you, because there, you know, when you think about it, what mechanisms out there exist today to do that organically? I mean, you could say going to a college or a university is one way to get that. But again, you might get an academic view on things, not to be confused with someone that's been in the trenches, the man in the arena, so to speak.
Yes, yes. Okay, so last question. Just maybe what advice might you give an aspiring entrepreneur as he or she thinks about taking the plunge, taking the leap?
Well, number one, first and foremost, is don't be afraid to fail. And then just understanding that failure is really part of your learning journey. So being able to be adept at picking yourself up, dusting yourself off, and going back at it tomorrow is one of the most valuable lessons you can learn or assets that you can have in your backpack. I think the other thing is not every idea is worth pursuing. So like with us, one of the things that I was trying to avoid, because I've had historically leadership in my company that were very passionate about something that you couldn't actually tie to any form of reality. So the whole notion of, you know, sometimes measure a couple times where you cut something, mm-hmm. you know, just make sure that, you know, you have you're making an informed decision. I think informed decision making is so critical, but unfortunately, sometimes it's a skill that you actually have to kind of curate over time.
Yeah. Okay. So don't be afraid to fail and go ahead and make an informed decision instead of just going all in with something you don't know about.
Absolutely. And then that happens a lot. As a matter of fact, I mean, I did a startup in Colorado several years back, was based on really a lot of we'll just say emotional hype over an opportunity. Come to find out, though, that that particular opportunity had already been solved by some really, really big companies. No one knew about it, though. So that was, it's a very quick way to shatter your hopes and dreams all in one shot.
Make an informed decision. Frank Ono, thank you for joining me on the show today. Thank you for sharing your words of wisdom. Look forward to spending some time with you working on igniting this entrepreneurial revolution.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Truly enjoyed sharing the story of Frank Ono. iFish Group builded this kind of behind-the-scenes, hyper-successful company right here in the Sacramento region, right? One of the fastest-growing companies in the region, one of the best places in the region to work. And you don't hear about certain entrepreneurs as often because they're not as front-facing. And at the beginning of the show, I talked about growing a business and starting a business, and what is the one ingredient that we all need if we want to start a business, grow a business, really do something spectacular in our lives. And Frank touched on this a little bit, but I'm going to go a little bit deeper. Doing this this game that we call entrepreneurship, it's not for everybody. And I think the first thing that we need to do when we decide whether we're going to start a business or grow a business or take on this enormous effort, this enormous undertaking, the first thing we need to do is a little bit of a self-assessment. Because I think really anything is possible if we overcome enough of the obstacles in the way. But the question is, do we have the one ingredient? Do we have the commitment? Do we have the commitment to start? Number one, I think there's really three areas of commitment that we have to look at if we're gonna do anything. Is do I have the courage to go for it? Right? Do I have the courage to start? And a lot of us don't. We sit on the sidelines and we evaluate, we procrastinate, we analyze, and those kind of things can drag out years, and we really never end up taking the leap. And so one of the first things we have to do is really do a self-assessment. If we're thinking about starting a business, do I have the courage to start? And some people do, some people don't. But if you do, what happens along the way, and this is something I don't think you understand if you're a first-time entrepreneur, but as you get a little bit older in life, you sort of begin to understand whether you have what I'll call a medium-term level commitment, right? We many times we have the ability to start something, and that takes a certain kind of courage, but to persevere, as Frank talked about on the show, and as we have heard from every entrepreneur that's ever been on the show and shared their story, and I can attest to this as somebody that has been battling in entrepreneurship, we need this medium-term commitment, because medium-term, there's going to be a lot of obstacles that we don't expect, and we're going to need that commitment to press through. We're going to need that commitment to persevere, and then we also need long-term commitment. I'll talk about that in a second, but it was my wife got new insurance for us, our new insurance card, and so I was pulling out my insurance card, the old one, and going to discard it and get the new one. So I pulled out my wallet, and it ended up making me sort of like reorganize my wallet. So I'm kind of doing this while we're on the air here. I just kind of pulled out the credit cards. I got this Growth Factory business card, and you know, I got a car wash thing and a couple of credit cards. And I started looking for that insurance card, and I couldn't find it. And I finally found it. Here's my CCW, my concealed weapons permit, just hiding back here. What else I got in here? Jeez. Okay, first thing I found was this business card that I had written on quite a few years ago. It's funny. It's my Northern Video Systems business card. That's the company that Scott, my AV guy over here, helped us build. My brother Paul helped us build. We had a group of buddies that sort of started off in video stores and then took it to security cameras, and we grew up pretty big. And at one point, we had decided that we could get to a billion. We had hit the 100 million in revenue spot mark, and we decided, you know what? We started having that medium-term commitment level kick in, right? We had to start, hey, we'd sort of jump in and figure it out, and then as we began to get a little bit of confidence, we started developing that medium-term commitment. And I wrote down my thoughts one day, and this was back in 2007. Wow. So yeah, this was right before the financial crisis. Be myself, appreciate my friends and family, remember where I came from, and then get to a billion by 2015. Okay, which is interesting. Get to a billion in sales. We were a little over 100 million at that point. Maybe we were at 150 million. I can't really remember. But I'd like to write things down and revisit them. I hadn't pulled out this business card in a while. But we ended up in 2010, a few years later, we ended up merging with another company and getting bought by a private equity group. And that group of people, I stayed with the company for a short period of time. We were at about 400 million in sales when I left. But that group of people ended up taking the company to well over $1 billion and ultimately got bought by a much larger company. And it created opportunity for a number of people. Businesses change when all that happens, but the goal ended up happening without me, but I think it ended up happening in a cool way. And I think, you know, the last time I remember pulling out this card, I wrote underneath my new vision, and this was in 2016, 11/2016, so that was about 5 years ago. I wrote, develop 100 millionaire business partners in my backyard that love each other. Kind of interesting. That's a 5 year. So that was 5 years ago. I started the podcast maybe 8 years ago. And I battled. When I started the podcast, it was like, what am I going to do? Because I had sold the companies and began helping some small businesses on almost like a dare. We started the podcast and the radio show. And I've been trying to figure out what do we want to do with this show? What do we want to do with these small businesses that we've begun investing in? But there really wasn't a master plan until 11/16. I wrote this down. I said, well, you know, I had this vision. I could see it. 100 millionaire business partners in my backyard that love one another. Well, we were still battling and trying to figure out how we were going to make this happen. And we kept doing some investing, and some of the investments really turned out well. Some of them didn't turn out so well, but enough did where we started getting some confidence. And I had this backyard party, and we ended up sharing this story. And this was just before COVID, and ended up attracting a guy named Rick Spencer to the team. And Rick's been a godsend and kind of a game changer for us. But what ended up happening is when COVID hit, right, we really went back to that ingredient. What's our commitment level? What's our commitment level to this 100 millionaire business partners in the backyard that all love each other? And the three of us were committed, Monique, myself, Monique Brown, our other co-founder, and Rick, and we're committed to doing this, but how are we going to do it? What are we going to do with what we've got? And we ended up starting something called the Growth Factory. And the Growth Factory is unique. It adds a new dimension because we wanted to find a way to rally the leaders of Sacramento to help this cause, right? People in Sacramento understand the value of entrepreneurs succeeding. That's good for everybody. When your neighbor succeeds, it's good for the neighborhood. When Sacramento entrepreneurs succeed, it's good for all of Sacramento. So we've been rallying the leaders of Sacramento to support the most promising startups in the region. That's under the umbrella of the Growth Factory, a startup accelerator with an accompanying venture fund and this backyard advantage. But it begins with the commitment. I think this longer-term commitment ties back to my original mission statement that I wrote after selling the companies around opportunity for my family, friends, and community. And as they succeed, then I succeed. And because the leaders have begun coming together, it's beginning to work. We invested into our first 15 companies. Investors are coming on. Frank, who came on earlier in the show, is committed to being involved. Other people, other leaders of Sacramento are understanding what we're working on. And I think commitment, right? If the commitment is strong enough, then other people recognize that, like Rick coming on board when he saw my commitment, Frank coming on board when he discovered our commitment. And the commitment is contagious, right? It's that one ingredient. It's so contagious if it's strong enough, if it's long term. That's the difference in the commitments, right? We have this beginning thing where we're willing to jump off, and some people will join us when we're getting ready to like jump off the cliff, right? Or jump into a game. You can get a certain type of person to sort of go with you and take that risk. And then that medium kind of commitment is like, hey, are these people that will fight through the tough times? We want those people on our team, but it's that long-term commitment. When people see long-term commitment, never-ending commitment, battling through figuring out how to do a podcast, figuring out how to make these investments, figuring out how to rally people to come together. When they see it year after year after year, it's a little bit contagious, and that's what's happening with the Growth Factory. So as part of my commitment, as part of this never-ending commitment, I recruited back my son to help us with the Growth Factory. I recruited him back. He saw how committed I was. He's like, Dad, you sure you don't need any help? And I'm like, I will take your help, Marcus. Marcus is a veteran, war hero, and now a part of the Growth Factory, a part of this commitment. He was already a part, but now he's in the inner circle with Monique and Rick and myself and Scott and Tammy and the other teammates that we have here. He's now back on the team. And I think that, to me, that's a demonstration of my commitment. My commitment. I am so committed to this thing that I'm going to take one of the most talented people I know who is, he can be a game changer. He's already begun. He's the guy that introduced me to Frank Ono, right? He's coming on board because of my commitment, because of Monique's commitment, because of Rick's commitment. He saw that and he says, hey, do you need me? And I said, heck yes. So Marcus, he's been a big inspiration. Some of you know that he helped me start the podcast originally. And he knows many of our friends and many of the people that have been on the show and many of the most successful people in Sacramento. And so with Marcus's help, I'm able to sort of take some of my shyness and bring in his outgoing personality. And together we're going out and we're reaching out to all the people that we know that likely would want to be a part of this Growth Factory effort. But it started with the commitment, and it started with this inspiration to do something important. And I think part of the reason I started the show is like, I want to do something important. And I didn't know for sure what it was. And we discovered it was, you know, what's possible. And the 100 millionaires in the backyard seems possible, right? It's like, what are we going to do with what we got? Well, we have a lot of connections in and around Sacramento. We're ingrained and entrenched in the startup community. We could help do this. We probably as much as almost anybody are positioned that we could do this. And it's an important thing. It's a lifetime achievement kind of mission, an effort, and because I wanted to do something that made Marcus proud, proud of me, because I'm so proud of him, so proud of what he did and his friends have done for our country. Like, what can I do for the good of society? What can I do for this hometown that I love? What can I do to make someone like my son Marcus proud? And that was really the idea behind these 100 millionaire business partners in the backyard that love each other. It's like, shoot, that sounds almost impossible. But if I did that, what kind of change would that make for Sacramento? What kind of change would that make for those founders? What kind of change would that make for my family? What kind of change would that make for society? And I can tell you it's taken some perseverance. It's taken some of that short-term commitment for sure to start and to say it out loud and then to try to persevere through it. And we're still persevering, but it's starting to work. And now it's that long-term commitment stage where we are just getting after it in a great way. And so I'm super excited to have my son, Marcus, who has joined us with the Growth Factory. If you have a dream, if you have something, if you're thinking, I want to expand my business or I want to start my business, it's think about what stage you're at. Maybe it's that first level of just sort of jump in, but be thinking about that next level, right? Do I have the commitment to persevere? And do I have that that commitment to really take it all the way? And if you do, people will see that. If you do, people will recognize that. If you do, people will join your team. And I am first world proof of, you know, if you don't have talent, just bring the commitment and people will just jump on board. So with gratitude here for the, at the first of the year, starting the new year fresh, super excited about the people that are jumping on board to commit with the Growth Factory, super excited about the first 15 portfolio companies that we have invested into, and really optimistic about what we are in the process of building. And I can tell you, my friends, that I am committed. I'm committed to my family. I'm committed to my friends, business partners, and I'm committed to this hometown that I love. So to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship, for our freedom, our security, and our way of life, I'm never above you, never below you, always by your side.
Twilight.